content of this program is intended for people who are print and visual impaired. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the Triangle Radio Reading Service studio. I am ably assisted by my engineer, Shay Hargett-Hill. Shay, thank you very much for helping us out today. And for the next half hour, we'll be exploring topics to champion your legal rights to obtain equal access and full participation in your community and for achieving goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies, as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on law supporting independent living. And today's episode, I'm very pleased to have a return guest, Derek Dittmer. Derek, thank you for returning.
Oh, Joe, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me back, man.
Fabulous. Glad to have you. If you missed our last edition of this, Derek is a graduate of Randolph-Macon College. He's a Raleigh guy and is a rising third-year student at Campbell University School of Law, where he is on law review. Congratulations, Derek.
Thank you, Joe. I really appreciate that. I enjoy it now because I'm not currently in the middle of reading a bunch of articles. Once I'm back in the middle of that, I'll enjoy it in a very different and slightly more tired way.
I heard that. Derek, just to remind our listeners, Derek is visually impaired from birth. He is very talented, multi-talented, and he has a very talented brother named Shane. And what's going on with Shane? We were hoping to get him on the program, too.
You know what? Shane would love to join us today. He and his fiance are preparing to move across the country to the state of Washington. We're incredibly proud of him, but preparing to move out west and drive is quite a bit. And unfortunately, between that and working as the musical director and as a piano player for a local musical coming up, production of Into the Woods, he was unfortunately unable to join us today. But he sends his regards and might try to find a time for us to do something remotely with him once he's settled in the state of Washington.
Fantastic.
Yes,
that's
sir.
Great. And good luck to Shane. You completed 2 years of law school very successfully.
Thank you, sir.
And you're looking forward to a third year of more achievement. We've talked about this, and tell me a little bit about how law school has maybe reframed how you think about things and how you organize your thoughts to for disputation and discussion and advocacy.
You know, that's a really great question. One of the best lessons I've learned in law school is that a lawyer does not necessarily have all of the answers, but they know where to get them. And so there's a comfort in discomfort that, you know, you'd establish in Socratic method when you're stood up and asked questions that nobody knows the answer to, and when you don't know them, made to feel as if you should. In the same way that when traveling with a service animal or with a cane, sometimes we don't know the answers, and that can be terrifying for people. But one of my favorite little phrases to remind myself is once you get lost, you have the opportunity to get unlost. Law has helped me in that way of sort of realizing that I don't need to know everything, I just need to trust myself and develop the processes to find those answers. When you get lost, you find your way home. When you don't know your answer, you find it. It allows me to ask more questions of myself, to dig to that deeper issue, and to go and sort of establish a way of coming to conclusions rather than feeling like I need to have them all. That sort of training really helps you with quick assessment, with analyzing a situation, with thinking critically, and with realizing that even after you've done all of that thinking and all of that preparing and you have comprehension of the answer, you now have to communicate it. Unfortunately, we look a lot in the legal community at using words that only make sense within the legal community. If I were saying, hey, I'm going to go file a 12b6 motion today, not many people would know what that means, including at one point myself. And so I believe very strongly that we have a responsibility as you, Joe, as an attorney, and me as a baby lawyer, as a third-year law student, to communicate those ideas to other people. To communicate them in a way that they can understand, because the duty to be understood is placed upon the shoulders of the communicator. So when I'm talking about, for example, why I'm not going to show the ID of my service animal to a restaurant owner, I'm not going to just say, well, it's a law, so shove off, even though I very well could, and sometimes I want to. I need to try to put it in their shoes and help them try to understand, at least from their perspective, where the question's coming from. I'll explain that in showing the ID, it's going to say guide dog for the blind, which is obvious, but for other people, you know, assistance dog for persons with anxiety, PTSD assistance dog, and forcing somebody to disclose their medical status before they get fed is pretty much against any sort of law in aspect of justice that we have in our society. That's just an example of how the idea of law and the training has helped me to think critically and get to the answer, and then once I have the answer, be able to communicate it in somebody else's terms. The law is a beast, and the community hasn't done a great job over the last 100 years or so of making it understandable. Everybody needs a lawyer, but nobody knows what's happening, and that's something that I hope to change, and I act to change as a law student and as a future lawyer and as an advocate for the disabled.
Very interesting perspective on that, Derek, and I don't think young people or middle-aged people or old people who go to law school necessarily understand what it is that they are going to encounter when they get in. And this business of thinking like a lawyer and the analysis that goes into it is can sometimes be a little bit foreign. And I know that from my own experience, I almost anticipated that we would have a set of legal maxims to memorize, and that would be legal training. But that's not the case, is it?
No, it's brainstorming. I think the best advice I ever got as a law student was to be human, and that was from a gentleman named David who's in the public defender's office. And I got a chance to do lunch with him last summer, and he said this, that's going to always stick with me. And he said, in all things, be human. You are a son, a brother, a friend, a romantic partner, eventually a husband, a father, a colleague, a confidant, all these things before you are a lawyer. And people who put the lawyer first in their worldview and in their view of self start thinking like a lawyer, which you have to be able to do, but then they start talking like a lawyer and they start acting like a lawyer, and I try to push myself to talk more like a human, because we are dealing with the law, but we're also dealing with humans.
That very good points. And of course, there is the analysis to it, but doctrinally, we've got to get competent on that as well. And I think that really is the hard part. It's, we've got to think and analyze, but we still have to know something.
Right.
And one thing I say quite often to people is, everybody's a lawyer these days. Mm. They look it up on the internet, and there is some black letter rule or some law that's spelled out, but how do you apply that in real life and to the facts of a case? That's the hard part.
And how has it been applied, and why, and how will it be applied? And, you know, black letter law has the word reasonable a lot, and people just skim over that. But as a law student, and Joe, I'm sure with your experience, when you see the word reasonable, you sort of crack your neck and stretch your fingers and realize, okay, now we have to settle in.
Yeah.
Because that's where the work begins.
Yeah. And one interesting insight that I can share with you, Derek, is the law of negligence. Mm. All trials these days have gotten to the point where they're like the D-Day invasion. All trials are so complicated, but the one area of the law that has weathered the time has been the 3 or 4 issue negligence case. Mm-hmm. That is still something that lawyers can put the case on to 12 people off the street, and they can apply the law of negligence to motor vehicle accidents. And I would say that If we could get everything down to the point where we've got a body of doctrine and a way to lay it out, that we'd be a lot better off. So when you get out of law school, you'll be the one to figure that out.
Well, no pressure.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some specific projects that you've got going on, and you've got a lot going on. Tell our audience about the service animal project at Campbell.
So Campbell has a wonderful major focus on pro bono, on service. It is a service community, and it definitely, one of the unspoken or at least unpublished mottos at Campbell is that the most important person in the room is the future client. So it's a very community-focused law school. It's one of the reasons I picked it, and I have a lot of respect for our dean for pushing it in that way. Our service animal training program, or service animal project, is a pro bono project. We partner with the Disability Rights North Carolina, and we go into the community and we do presentations on service animal law and service animal etiquette. I have the privilege and the honor of serving as the coordinator for the project for the 2018-2019 school year. And so my job, as I see it, is to go into the community and find people that who have needs in relation to service animals and to try to address those needs and be a very almost business customer-focused model. And there are two needs that I typically run into. The first is in the service animal community. Somebody comes to me and says, this restaurant, this taxi company, this bar, this museum is not letting me in with my service animal. Please help. And the second is a restaurant or a bar or an organization that says, we are getting a lot of people coming in with fake service animals, with emotional support animals, with which I'm not calling fake service animals. Those are two different categories, with animals that ought not be in here, but that they are trying to claim that are here. And these organizations don't know how to protect themselves and to protect their clients and to protect those of us with service animals. I'm here with my guide dog, Howard, who is just passed out on the floor. And so we go into these organizations and we do trainings. And the goal of these trainings are short, is to give them, here's what you need to know. Here's what your obligations are and your rights are as an organization, as a business, as a bar, as a restaurant. And here's what the obligations and rights are of the service animal users. Unfortunately, people with fake service animals, they get a little card with some of the places that send the jacket, and it says, if you get questioned, threaten to sue. Which is terrifying for, a microbrewery or a wine bar or a small cafe, because they don't want that. And so my goal with the team is to come in and leave having these people with the knowledge that what they're doing is right and within the law, and that they have people that they can ask, so that they can protect themselves, protect their clients, and protect those of us with service animals. And so that we can be protected from people that aren't doing what they need to do. It is so rewarding to do a 20-minute training, answer questions. People are so interested in learning. It comes from a place predominantly of lack of knowledge rather than malice. And then to be able to come back, I did a training with a couple other people from the project back in January, and I was just back at the establishment over the last couple weeks and watched somebody come in with just a poodle and have them be like, oh, this is my emotional support animal, and have the people that we trained respectfully address that situation and say, I understand that. Do you mind if we serve you outside? It was one of the coolest things that I've ever seen and been a part of. It's change on a small level, but it's change on a real level, and I loved it.
I won't say it's a problem. Mm-hmm. It is an issue that people are more and more bringing their animals to public places, public accommodations, and passing off Jip or Fluffy as a service animal, and there's no way that dog is performing any work.
Right.
The dog is going from person to person at the table and certainly being charming, we hope, but not a service animal. Is that a problem, or is it just an issue? What, and is that something that sounds like that's something you're addressing with this project?
That is something we're addressing with this project, and it becomes an issue. It becomes a problem, I think, in a couple ways. First is that it's hard enough working a service animal day to day, where every 10 minutes is, can I pet the puppy? And it's hard enough going into places where they're concerned or they're afraid of the dog. When people come in with these untrained animals, the assumption is that now, you know, one service animal acted like this, so all service animals are going to act like this, which makes it more difficult for me as a service animal user with a very – the dog is better trained than I am, Joe. Let's be completely honest. It's challenging for me to come in and have to clean up that mess and to have to clean up that mess and to be responsible for that. There's also a safety issue, right? The service animals are allowed into restaurants by law, but other animals are not. And these restaurants, if they have a fictitious service animal or if they're just letting in dogs willy-nilly, can have issues with the health codes. They can have issues with ABC licensure for selling alcohol. They can have issues being able to even remain open. Heaven forbid Fluffy or Jip gets mad because they're not getting enough carnitas and bites somebody or has an accident on the floor. Granted, those are issues with, you know, possibly any dog. Dogs are, in fact, dogs. But that's the issue we're getting into, is that if this is a right that we have and that we need to rely on, I think it's also one that we need to protect with respect to everybody and in a way of making sure that people with legitimate needs are able to have those needs met. But that people that don't have those and just want to bring Jip into the restaurant because it's convenient for them, if Jip's poorly behaved, then we get issues, particularly when we run into issues of our service animals being at harm. My Howard has been growled at. He has been bitten at. He has been bitten by other dogs. I am not comfortable going into restaurants where that is a risk to him or to me.
That's a good point. They get his guilt by association. They've had a bad experience with somebody's faux service animal, and so they take it out on you, and you're legitimate.
It's basically puppy profiling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, the fear factor. You are a user of Uber. Mm-hmm. I think we can say that.
I Uber here, so I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. So, not to say anything bad about it, but do you get different reactions from different drivers?
You do. You absolutely do. And there's a respect thing of people are afraid of the dogs, and it's unfortunate. And I try to be very respectful of that. If I get into an Uber and the person is afraid of Howard, I'm very careful. I sit in the back, and he sits between my knees, and I keep his little – I say little. He's got a massive head. I keep that on my lap, and I scratch it the entire time and play with his ears and keep it distracted on me, and he usually just drifts off to sleep. That's pretty calming for people. There's a difference for me with that, and I want to be respectful to people's fears. But he helps in such a dramatic way. And he helps with my ability to navigate. And so it's a balancing act. I will tell you, working in the public defender's office this summer as an intern, I've not had many clients, but I have had some that are afraid of the dog. And I am perfectly happy to put the dog in my office. We have a little sign on the door that says, please don't knock or come in, service animal at rest. And then we have another son that said, yes, that means you don't pet the puppy. We had to add that one. Second. That's a joke. but we have that place for him, and I'll take a cane and go down to the courtroom or go into the meeting room. Because for these people, kind of going back to what we were saying earlier, being in court for criminal charge is often the scariest day of their life. I have no interest in making that worse. So it's a balancing act.
Well, I'm glad you brought up your work this summer. I hope it's going well.
It's going great. I'm very lucky to work with some very, very good people.
So now it's one thing to study the law, and you have overcome many challenges in the study of law. Mm-hmm. What kind of challenges are you having to confront or encounter now that you are taking that legal education and putting it into legal work?
I mean, they're the basics. I'm working in criminal defense. The question of how I'm going to look at dash cam footage, of how I'm going to look at a scene picture or of a Google map or of a client. There are some clients that, you know, you want to be very, very intentional about, especially when you prepare people for trial. One of the recommendations is that if it's going to be a big trial in front of a jury, you want them dressed well. I'm not comfortable asking a client, what are you wearing? That's gets a little into some territories that I'm not comfortable touching. So a lot of that, comes with questions and with relying on good eyes around me. There are people I've been very lucky that, it's not a huge problem, but from what I've heard from other people around the country, they'll encounter other attorneys that are more interested in asking questions about the blindness than they are about letting the person do their job. And from hearing from other blind associates around the country, they sometimes find that it's challenging. It's challenging to do what they need to do when people are treating them like a curio rather than a colleague. And so something I've had to be very prepared to do is respectfully say, listen, I want to have this conversation with you. I also want to have a conversation with my client who's currently incarcerated. They're going to come first. And be very polite, and just everything I do, it's got to be for the client. A lot of the time, you can actually turn the disability into flip it on its head. And respectfully, I think I can listen more than somebody with sight would typically listen for. I pick up on things in voices and people. I mean, Joe, I'm sure you have this experience when you're flying across the country or when you're traveling on your own. You have to meet a stranger if you're by yourself and get them to trust you enough to show you where the restroom is. That sort of ability to make friends and to be trustworthy quickly, to have the charisma to engage with the public and have really anybody around turn into your eyes, is very useful when working with a client or with a victim or with another attorney, whether it's a district attorney or a defense attorney or with a judge. The ability to connect is important, and it's an ability you have to have if you're going to succeed independently in a sighted world.
I hadn't thought about that. That is very insightful and a very good point. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So you're being in the public defender's office and doing criminal law. For our listeners who are not legally trained, there's, one or two courses in the law school, a curriculum for criminal law and procedure, and then everything else is civil.
Mm-hmm.
How are you finding this experience? Sounds like you're enjoying it.
I'm loving it. I really am. I'm blessed to work with just a wonderful supervisor and a wonderful staff of office full of people and other great interns. I could not be more thankful or more blessed to work with a good group of people.
That's great. So are you getting into evidentiary issues and as well? That's really where the rubber hits the road, doesn't it? I mean, that's where the case gets put on, getting your evidence in and cross-examining the other side's witnesses.
I'm getting to frolic in that a little bit, but most of this summer I'm in the misdemeanor division, and so most of the summer has been trying to figure out what people need and what their story is and tell it. Growing up, I've always loved stories. I've been an avid reader, and everybody that comes, through the door has a story. And so a lot of my job this summer has been less arguing evidentiary motions, arguing, can this be suppressed, or did they have a reason to stop this person? And a lot more trying to help people get their story told and see what we can handle with the district attorney. A lot of the time, we're very lucky in that people are willing to listen and are willing to share and are willing to kind of cards on the table, be honest with one another. And so we're not having a lot of things right now going farther than they need to. I think in some places in the country, things go to trial when they shouldn't. If it's very clear, people don't have, the humility or the honesty that I see in a lot of attorneys on both sides here in Wake County, to listen to each other and to be heard and to be honest and to be humble enough to address a case where it is. And so we have the ability to say, hey, here's where we are. They did this or they did that or they didn't do this or we don't have this information or this person isn't here, and have something taken care of quickly and efficiently. So not everything is going to trial, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. More of what I have been this summer than a evidence guru is a problem solver, is a brainstormer, is a confidant, is a neutral party, is a soundboard, is a recommendation dispenser, is an advocate and is a storyteller. And those are all aspects of the law that we don't see on TV or in the movies or in the books. But they're so valuable.
Did you and I talk about Rumpole the Bailey?
We did.
Okay.
We did. It's on my reading list.
All right. Well, I think you'll thoroughly enjoy Rumpole the Bailey, old Bailey hack. And next time we get together, we'll talk about, compare some stories.
But, I'd love that.
Good.
I'd love that.
So we've got a few minutes, a few seconds left. Care to give a shout out to your friends at NC Disability Rights?
I've been so thankful to work with Ms. Stiles over at Disability Rights North Carolina. She has been a great mentor for the Service Animal Project. She trains our students on the law and provides us all the information we need to go and pass that information to folks in the community. Knowledge is power. And the idea of the ripple effect, that you drop a stone in the water and the ripples go farther than you can possibly imagine, I think definitely applies to her and to the other people at the RNC and their work. And really just to this broadcast as well and to what you all are doing. I think we sometimes aren't good at sharing with one another or acknowledging what a comment or a fact or a story or a support can do. And I just would hope that she and the other people at Disability Rights North Carolina and the folks here at the reading service know the impact that they're making.
You've given me your card. Tell our listeners about your card. I mean, it's got your basic information, your contact information, but on the back of it, you've got...
I had a little bit of fun with it.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to work with Kelly Noble. She's one of the career developers at Campbell Law School. She's been my go-to person, and she's just incredible. So I went to her and I said, Kelly, I need a card, but I don't know what they look like. Help me. And we designed this beautiful card that I'm very proud of. It's got a corner cut off in the top left so that I can make sure I'm giving out my cards and not Joe's. And so that people who with visual impairments, if they're trying to get an OCR scan, optical character recognition, can know that they're holding it the right way. On the back, it has what's called a QR code. And a QR code is something that you can scan with a phone camera, and it'll pull up a link and take you directly there. In my case, it takes me to a LinkedIn profile with my email address. So the goal is that if we have people with visual impairments that have that sort of technology, they don't have to take a scan and risk it being bad and getting numbers wrong or email letters wrong. And they don't have to have somebody say to read it to them. You just run your phone over the back of the card with the cutout in the top right-hand corner, and it'll take you straight to my email address.
Well, Derek, we've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Wonderful guest for returning to our program. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you, Joe. My pleasure.
And to our listeners, please be sure to tune in next time on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m. We rebroadcast the following Wednesday at 7 a.m. We hope you've enjoyed the show and discovered information about your legal rights and for obtaining equal access and full participation in your community. I'm Joe Austin, your host. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After it's broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.trianglereadingservice.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode, or if you wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138. You can also reach us via email at info@trrsnc.org. We look forward to hearing from you, and we look forward to getting together again next month. Thank you.